With that, I'll open it up for questions and we'll get the management team up here if that's okay. Does anybody want to start? We'll have a microphone that we can hand out to you in the audience so everybody can hear the question too as well. Okay. It was all self-explanatory. There's one in the back. He just feels sorry for us. Or she, I'm not sure. I can't see that far.
Could you give perhaps your price projections over the next year or two on oil and gas?
All I know is they're going to be robust. As many of you know, picking prices in this business is bound to have disastrous consequences. We had thought actually that with the economic slowdown that both crude oil and natural gas would weaken. Part of why we feathered in some additional hedges in 2009 is we actually thought the gas markets would weaken. Sitting back last fall looking at the world in terms of potential LNG production, a normal winter or the kind of warm winters we've been having, record natural gas inventories, growing onshore production, our own Independence Hub production coming on stream, Rockies Express opening up the Rockies area to more production. And here we sit with gas that we put a floor at $7.50 on, trading at $9 plus. And so we've been understandably using three-way collars because of our uncertainty about the volatility around the pricing. We hung back on oil. The oil hedges that Al mentioned were done some time ago. We have felt fairly bullish about that for quite some time. We again thought it would retreat a bit during the economic slowdown, but it's defied gravity partly because of the exchange rate issue. So that all I can tell you is that we believe it'll be robust. I think that Al's numbers in terms of the price deck he used are ones that we feel very confident will be there at the end of the day. We certainly hope for better for the production side of our business. We don't hope for better for the consumption side of the industry. But I think, unfortunately, we're in a world where we have a number of countries going through a very energy inefficient portion of the cycle. And while those countries may slow down from their tremendous growth rates, it doesn't mean energy demand will slow. And we don't have great answers in this industry for how you stop the supply and demand fundamentals working. And all I would tell everybody to do is make sure you turn off your lights when you leave your rooms, because consumption is the only real good near-term answer we have if, in fact, prices even defy economic downturn here. Yes, sir. Yeah, the first part I might ask Carl to take, if you would, and then I can ask Al to talk about the second part.
Yeah, the breakout on the increased spending, you'll see it spent in several different areas. One is Marcellus Shale. We'll probably spend around $75 million incremental this year up there, as we talked about the program. We'll add a couple rigs in some areas, South Texas, Natural Buttes. With our horizontal success in Carthage, we may look at adding a rig there. A lot of that will be spread across some of our programs. Another big chunk of that excess capital or incremental capital will go to the midstream build-out, too. As we accelerate these programs, we're going to accelerate our midstream build-out also. And then we also spent $143 million last week on the MMS lease sale. So some of that money will be allocated to that area also. Yeah.
I think as it relates to free cash flow, our ability to reinvest at around that $5 billion number that I showed you in that one graphic is probably a good capital spend number for us. So the free cash flow over and beyond that, we anticipate, will go to debt retirement.
And it'll be you're building up dry powder. I mean, from our perspective, the rating agencies have been very patient with us. It's the first time in my career that we've actually said we were going to do something and didn't do it. And I'm not proud of that. I don't think it's good policy. It's worked out very well for our equity shareholders. At the end of the day, we've delivered even for the rating agencies. But someday we will need them again, and we've got to make sure that we continue to make progress. Now, the reason why that's still great for all of us is we build up dry powder, and our objective is actually not to be just high investment grade. It's actually to have about a 30% debt-to-cap ratio. We're going to get benefit from the retained earnings line, and we're going to get benefit from putting cash on the balance sheet. And then we can go out and do something magical again, like the Western Kerr-McGee transactions, where we were inefficiently leveraged prior to those acquisitions, inefficiently over-leveraged after those acquisitions, are now getting back into the sweet spot we really believe we need to be at strategically, which has nothing to do with the rating agencies at the end of the day, which is actually lower than the metrics they even want. And that's because if we have a couple of major deep water discoveries that may take 8 ACE, $4 billion or $5 billion to execute upon, we don't have to want to be forced into selling down those unless we want to, unless we think that value creation is a better answer. So for us to have some dry powder either for executing our organic program or for taking advantage of consolidation opportunities is a real plus.
Should you be consolidating in the current environment where prices are right now?
Well, I think that a number of people have held off from doing that starting at $30 a barrel thinking they were at the high end of the price cycle. So it depends. Some people thought that we were buying at too high of premiums back when gas was trading at $5.50 in the cash market, right? The 40% premiums we paid for those two entities and above, people thought was idiotic. Well, here we sit today. So it's not to say that we would buy at $100 oil. It just means that if we see value at the price deck that exists relative to what our own projections are internally, we'll continue to play the game. And we think there's still a great arbitrage in the corporate market, just like there was before. But we're not in the position to do that today. Yes, sir.
What wellhead price do you need for cash flow break-even, both on and off the fairway in the greater Natural Buttes area?
I'm not sure I heard the question either. Chuck might want to answer. Can you ask it one more time?
Both on and off the fairway in the greater Natural Buttes.
Okay.
What wellhead price do you need for cash flow break-even, or put another way, what is your return on $8 gas?
Well, you saw in the presentation our returns were about 86% rate of return in the fairway and around 60% off the fairway. Those programs are robust well south of $4 an MCF.
At the wellhead?
At the NYMEX.
NYMEX. And what assumption are you using for the basis differential?
We're normally using between $1 and $1.50 to get to the wellhead.
Okay, thank you.
And as you may know, we showed the absolute outright NYMEX hedges there. Through 2010, we've effectively hedged out our basis differential in the Rockies, starting at $1.50 and below, and done the same in the Mid-Continent. So that was one thing we were focused on, regardless of where commodity prices kind of went. And that's through a combination of FT and basis hedging.
Jim,
yes.
In light of your comments that you just made, is there anything in your portfolio now that you've revamped it that you feel you have something you have too much of or not enough of?
We never have enough. one of the uses of those dollars that we talked about in terms of free cash flow before is that if we saw a really compelling new venture or exploration opportunity, that's one thing I think the management, even though they'd be committed to this $5 billion kind of program, is if there truly was extra cash flow, and Bob Daniels' group in particular bought us a great trade opportunity to get into an exploration prospect that had a five-year, kind of seven-year horizon, we jump all over that with excess cash flow, and I think that's exactly what our investors would want too. Because we didn't talk a lot about that possible piece in the red circle. We have done that in the past, but we tend to think the industry is getting a bit hyped up, if you will, by talking about ultimate potential, sometimes in gross terms, not even in net terms, sometimes in unrisk terms instead of risk terms. So we thought we'd get back to a bit more of a reliable circle of that 4 billion barrels plus 3 billion barrels of other stuff that we can bring into the fold, but it's not going to be immediate, and you shouldn't be focused on that. It's less sure, it's less certain in terms of timing. But we still want that red circle to be robust, and we think it adds real value. Now, part and parcel with that, and part of what Bob's team understands and what we go around kissing and hugging them for, is that to collapse that into a monetization vehicle is a wonderful, virtuous cycle. Because we can prove to our investors and validate, for example, what the Gulf of Mexico inventory is worth. It's absolutely stunning to look at our valuation as a company when you look at what's happened in the last couple of lease sales and what we've actually sold these Gulf of Mexico properties for. You do any kind of sum of the parts analysis on what our Gulf of Mexico inventory is worth, it would absolutely amaze you with numbers that are out in the street. For us to be able to validate some of that potential over time is still very important to our investors, very important to the management team, very important to the board. So that we would love to have more of the stuff like that in Brazil, in the Gulf of Mexico, in West Africa. But I think part and parcel with spending more money on that in that red circle is you have to see some validation for that if it's long dated in particular. So in other words, Peregrino, if it's coming on in 2010, that's okay. If it was coming on in 2015, which might be a lower tertiary project, that's a tougher one for you to put much value on. So occasionally we have to validate for you what that inventory is worth if we're going to continue to go spend money on it. So we want to actually get more of that, but we also want to deliver more on what we get as well, if that's part of the answer to that. But there aren't, somebody asked me some time ago, are there countries you wish you were in, areas of the world you wish you were in? And I would tell you it's tough right now for me to think of places that we are not. You think about the hottest areas in the world right now, it's Brazil, it's been West Africa for quite some time, and now the most expensive acreage in the world is in the Gulf of Mexico. And we've got this phenomenal position in unconventional resources onshore, which all of us know is part of the real answer to energy security and pricing in the United States, for example. So when we think about where we'd like to go, we used to think it was Russia years ago. We're not so sure anymore. We were in Venezuela. We're not so sure anymore. You can go country after country. Now, that will change over time. But part of the reason why we got a bit more domestic is we kind of liked what was happening here when we did those acquisitions. We continue to love certain segments of the international arena. But Bob's group, I think, is properly focused on the best places to go today. China, Indonesia, West Africa, Brazil, staying here in the deepwater Gulf of Mexico.
Hey, Chuck.
Yes.
Over here.
Quick, the lights are right on.
When you think about development timing, people focus on rig count in each of your areas. Can you talk some about your efficiency onshore, what you're seeing as far as well count increasing in each of the regions, and what you're also seeing on a cost per well?
Well, you know, across the number of fields we have, that's a very broad question. But in general, what we're seeing is a year-over-year improvement in our drilling efficiency. You saw the curve on greater natural buttes in the fracs. The same type of thing is happening in our drilling program. What we're doing is essentially moving more and more to pad drilling across the spectrum of our assets. And I was giving the example last night. If you look 2 or 3 years ago in Wattenberg, it took 6 or 7 days to drill a well. And it took a day or two to move the rig to drill the next well. And so you had a built-in 20 or 30% downtime. And with the pad drilling that we're doing now, we're essentially staying on location, drilling more and more wells for every rig move and improving our efficiency. And another example would be in greater natural buttes. We're doing more now with 8 company-operated rigs than we anticipated doing with 10 company-operated rigs this year. So the efficiency that we're getting, learning these curves, doing it one time after another, drilling 200 or 300 wells in each of the fields, every day we're getting those learnings and putting them back into the business. And the efficiency is more than offsetting the inflationary pressure that we've seen in the last 2 or 3 years in pumping services or drilling services, or, you know, you can just go down through the litany of costs that we see. So the efficiency is getting better, and we've been able to maintain or even drop our average well cost in Greater Natural Buttes, Wattenberg, Wamsutter, Carthage, and Bossier. We've seen tremendous cost gains. And so almost across the entirety of the portfolio, we've seen improved efficiencies.
And then one additional question. You didn't see an upward revision to expected recovery in the greater Green River Basin. Little surprise given some of the non-sand pay and extension drilling that's going on in Pinedale. Can you talk some about why you didn't uptick that resource potential?
Well, we have essentially relied on the ultra presentation so there's consistency in the marketplace. We're evaluating that. There's a large drilling program out there. There's thousands of wells to drill, over 6,000 wells in that portfolio of the Green River. And I see that as added potential that we'll look at over time. But just for consistency in the marketplace, we elected to use the ultra numbers.
I have a question on the Marcellus. Can you give us somewhat of your timetable You said 5 to 10 wells in 5 pilot areas. $75 million, can you kind of give us a breakout of, is that more leasing, what you plan to spend, so on and so forth?
Yeah. Right now we control about just under 600,000 acres gross in the Marcellus, and we've been adding to that. We got in very early, got some very very good acreage position for very low cost, and it's been going up. So as we add to it this year, we're spending more money on acreage than we had anticipated. So part of that $75 million will go into additional acreage. The area that we're focused, it was highlighted on that map, that is what we think is, I don't know if you'd call it a sweet spot, but it is the area that we see the most potential in, and that's where the dollars will be spent. The pilot programs that we've anticipated, one will be by another operator, and they will probably spud about May or June, and then the others will be our own operated drilling activities, and that's probably about the same time frame, starting in about June. The key thing there is getting the permits to allow us to get onto the acreage, and it's right now it's kind of a slow process up there. But with the activity, if we have success, that's where we will just continue to drill additional wells.
I'd like to ask about the process forward in Ghana. The cycle time, obviously, very impressive. Can you talk about how you get comfortable with some of the reservoir risks in such a short period of time, like compartmentalization and deliverability? And then also potentially talk about the processing facility concept, given the tightness that we see in the construction market right now.
Well, as you know, we've drilled two wells inside the reservoir proper, the Mahogany and the Shadua well. What we're going to do now this year is 3 additional delineation wells in the field proper, one of which we're going to do an extended well test on, which should help address many of the questions with regard to deliverability and compartmentalization. These are fairly shallow wells, so we can drill them fairly quickly. The partnership has now put together a project team, an integrated project team, to evaluate all the alternatives that we have with regard to developing the field. I think it's fair to say the front runner at this point is an FPSO. The idea being that with the size of the field, the variability in the size of the field from 200 million to 1 billion barrels, we need some flexibility in our processing capacity, so we're looking for vessels that we can put an initial processing plan on with an expansion capability. We're looking for a vessel that has water injection and gas injection capabilities, so if we need reservoir energy support, we can do so. So, in general, the concept is a very flexible approach to an initial production system. In the marketplace now, there's some availability for that type of vessel, large hull, FPSO, with the deck space that can do the types of things that we need to do. And we see the potential to have that boat positioned and producing as early as 2010.
Could I add one thing to that? Mm-hmm. Additionally, during the initial two wells that were drilled, you know, we got a lot of data. We acquired cores, lots of pressure data. The pressure data between the two wells, while not proving, but certainly gave you very, very strong indication of the reservoir continuity and the pressure connectivity. And then the core through the second well, I mean, the rock quality there is phenomenal. It's like Darcy-type permeability. So you've got very high porosities, very, very good permeabilities. You've got a good depositional system. This isn't something that is very isolated. This is a massive sand system that's coming through. So there's an awful lot of things underlying the assessment that we will then be testing to prove up that continuity.
There's one here, I think. Now we're getting up towards the front of the church. That's a good thing. It always works this way.
Do you think Anadarko would benefit from greater shareholder representation on the board?
I think it's a two-way argument. I think that closely held shareholders can be a real benefit. We've seen that in private equity transactions. I think in a public market they can also do that, and there have been plenty of instances of that as well. I would also tell you there have been plenty of abuses. And I think that's true in both private equity as well as in public equity, public corporations. We have significant shareholdings amongst our board, much more significant than most public corporations that I know of. from the lead director on down. So you've got two guys that built the prior companies that are the flagship companies in the business. They have significant holdings. I have significant holdings. I don't think our judgment is swayed by that. Just an interesting example of that is for years, Sonatrach has asked for a seat on our board, much like they did at Pan Energy when I used to be there. And Sonatrach had that same mirror position as a result of the settlement back during the Pan Am Eastern LNG debacle. And I think if you sat here today and said, would you like Sonatrach to be on your board, you might have a different answer than you might be intimating today. We've told them no for years because we don't think that just because you own shares is why you ought to be on a board. Public corporations were set up so that there could be a board that was representing all shareholders as opposed to an individual shareholder. But I think you have to examine that based on who the shareholder is and how that share ownership got to be part of that structure. And then you deal with that community. So I think there are pros and cons to it. But I think somebody coming off the street saying they own 5% of the company, much like Sonatrach did, that isn't a compelling enough argument to put somebody on a board. In fact, you as the other 95% might think that's the worst thing that could happen in some cases. Hope that answers it.
Jim, if you look at the onshore summary chart where you outline the Rockies and various other onshore U.S. plays, and you do a quick F&D, why would you keep the Texas MidCon assets? Because you're indicating a 360 MCFE finding a development cost, whereas your Rockies plays are roughly $1.75. Why not sell them and redeploy into a lower F&D environment?
Yeah. Chuck will get that map. Thanks. Good question.
Matt, the one thing we see is you look at that Texas Mid-Continent portfolio, that's the total investment by the new reserve adds. So it's inclusive of the CapEx we'll be putting into our PUD inventory that we have. That's one reason that the F&D skewed a little on that portfolio. I think the reason we can keep investing in the Texas Mid-Continent area, as we sit here today, some of our highest rate of return projects we have are in that portfolio. The South Texas Vicksburg, the East Tyler County chalk production that we have, and the Bossier play that we're in are some of the highest return projects we have in the company. They don't have the F&D metrics that others do, but certainly they have the return, the cash flow generation capabilities. They have high initial rates, so they bring a lot of pay out in quick, and that churn on that money is substantially greater than even the Rockies. So it's a balance that we're striking between rate of returns on individual investments and F&D for the organization.
What kind of pre-planning are you doing for the Rockies in terms of transportation? Because we're going to run through Rockies Express capacity pretty soon, and are you noodling on that? Thank you.
Yeah, I'll let Carl answer it. But what's interesting in terms of dynamics in the gas markets, as you all know, for the last couple of decades, what's become a truly North American market is the Canadian production declines have actually opened opportunities to go west again, which is kind of interesting. So, Carl, maybe you can.
Yeah, it gives me a chance to also highlight the combination of three companies, Anadarko, Western, and Kerr-McGee, really gives us a chance to bring some quality people into our portfolio. And, Bob, you know with Western how well they were at managing basis exposure and transportation takeaway capacity. And we basically left that skill set intact from Western. And we've got a great group of professionals and analysts in the marketing realm that handle the Rockies beautifully for us. We have been ahead of the curve on basis movements and on firm transportation needs with our portfolio, and we continue to do that. In fact, 2 weeks ago, we had a major presentation to our executive committee from that team highlighting our need for firm transportation going forward. And we're active in current negotiations on two or three projects that will add another 500 million to 600 or 700 million of firm transportation capacity. In conjunction, we continue to look at financial hedging with regards to basis exposure too in the Rockies. So we're managing our Rockies exposure on a takeaway capacity and basis risk capacity on out beyond 2010, 2011 right now. But we do think there's a need for additional pipe. REX is not the solution. It's just one step in a long-term solution.
What's intriguing to me, and it speaks again to consolidation actually having benefits to the development of free markets in many ways, is that the consolidation of our three entities up in the Rockies has been a boon, if you will, to this very issue you're speaking to, is that we now have a critical mass of production and midstream assets to actually care and want to lead the expansion. For example, neither of the three predecessor companies had a lick of FT on Rockies Express, not one MCF. We should be one of the primary underwriters of that kind of capacity in the future to get that built more quickly. So instead of having this horrible kind of rat going through the snake where it builds up at the first bite to this big a number and then gets down, pushed down another level and pushed down another level, you'll have a much more gradual and, if you will, take a sine wave, is that'll flatten a lot in the future in terms of not having so much built-up production. And that's what we want to achieve up in the Rockies, that we can actually anticipate and lead some of our production instead of always waiting until a critical mass of basically shut-in production builds up, which is exactly why it was compelling to buy Western in part, because Western had a lot of wells that were shut in without a water pipeline. We added the water pipeline, and now we're going to try to make sure we stay on top of the gathering, treating, compression, and downstream pipes. And we've got the incentive to do it now.
I might add, too, we manage our exposure in the Rockies on a takeaway basis. Just as we do the rest of our assets, we look at it from a portfolio standpoint. We want to mitigate risk. So you'll see us looking at opportunities to take gas east, west, north, and south. So we don't like the constraint of being all east, as we saw with Cheyenne Plains going down last year, put a lot of people in a big bind. So we're going to try to mitigate exposure by going different directions with our gas.
If I may, there appears to be a little less, I guess, industry enthusiasm towards the lower tertiary. And, you know, certainly from what we heard, a little more enthusiasm towards the lower Miocene. Can you perhaps highlight, you know, this lack of enthusiasm and this upbeat on the Miocene? Thanks.
Do you want to try it now, Ed?
Sure. I think that slide that I showed that had the discoveries and the cycle time really paints the picture there. The lower Miocene, the lower middle Miocene, because of the rock qualities and what we know about it, you can bring those on in a defined period of time. So you know when you invest and have a discovery that you can work through the infrastructure and create value that way. The lower tertiary still has a lot of unanswered questions. There's no doubt the hydrocarbons are there. It's a very significant resource in the deepwater Gulf of Mexico. But the producibility of it, the per well recoveries, the cost of the infrastructure all lead to very long cycle times. And I think when people stand back and if they have the opportunity, which we're in the fortunate position of being, and deciding where do we invest our capital, we can high-grade that portfolio mix and invest it in the things that create the most value for us now, and that is a shorter cycle time thing. We have a wonderful position in the lower tertiary, and there is value to be created there, and we will continue to do that. But given the choice right now of a Miocene test in the subsalt or lower tertiary, there's more value in the Miocene, and that's where we're going to be focusing 75% of our exploratory efforts.
And that's what it is. It's just a matter of degrees. As we still see the industry unlocking that resource potential in a resource-constrained world, it will happen. Just as many of us never, you know, defined deep water as being more than 300 feet at one point, and now we define it ultra-deep as being 10,000 plus, we will figure out a way to unlock the lower tertiary, which is why we want to continue to be active in that play type. But what we don't want to do is build our inventory too much ahead of the actual development cycle. So you're not going to see us test four or five of those, even though we could each year. We actually will do one or two each year. And then occasionally, depending on what the rest of our portfolio looks like and what appetite we have for that, we either hold it or monetize it. And I don't think the monetization we just did does anything but confirm that there was a lot of value in the exploration effort we put into the lower tertiary. That's why you saw us bid on lower tertiary prospects again. And we got one or two, and we lost one or two, and lost them by big numbers on the one or two we lost. So the industry still sees a lot of value in lower tertiary, as do we. It's just not as close a cycle time, as Bob mentioned, so we want to make sure we keep the mix right.
I would add also that In today's world, when you're out exploring in the Miocene trend or the Lower Tertiary trend, in the Miocene trend, given the infrastructure in the Gulf of Mexico, and it's starting to fill in, particularly in the Mississippi Canyon, Green Canyon, Garden Banks area, regardless of the size of the discovery that Bob's team make, we can monetize it. We from the P90 to the P10 range of that discovery, we have an option and a solution for that. Today, as we sit here, and it will change in 5 or 10 years, we don't have that opportunity right now. It takes the gargantuan discoveries in the Lower Tertiary to make a play right now to get to development. Whereas in the Miocene, any single discovery we have a shot at going commercial on, and that adds a lot of value, a lot of option value that we don't currently have in the Lower Tertiary.
Looks like we might have gotten all the questions we want to get yet. Obviously, John Colglazier is available, as is the management team, here for questions you might have subsequent to the meeting. We'll also, John, I think, be having a meal served out here for anybody who would like one. Also, some of us will be milling around if you have other questions that you'd like to ask. And thank you for coming, and have a great day.